Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilbourne. Hi,
Good
Caroline.
morning, everyone. I'm good, yeah.
Good, good.
I'm
and
good.
It's our book today is very fitting for February in Iowa, don't
true,
you think?
True.
Why don't you introduce our author?
Okay. Our book today is titled Girl in Ice, and it's written by Erica Forensic, and it's a page-turner for sure. And it's a, well, you know, it's just, you got to read it. That's all I can say. You got to read it.
I'll tell you
a little bit about the author. 35 years of writing, novels, short stories, essays, ghostwriting, 10 years of stand-up and sketch comedy, as well as dozens of screenplays and a brief filmmaking stint. And that was her boots on the ground training. Her work has appeared in Salon, in the Boston Globe, as well as on National Public Radio. Okay, now right now she lives in Metro West Boston with her very tolerant husband and frankly enormous Maine Coon cat. And I don't know what kind of cat that is.
Giant.
Are they sure it's a cat and not a dog? I mean, really.
You know, good point. He acts like he fetches.
Does he? Like, really?
I throw a little ball and he goes, get it. So, yeah, he's got the dog friend for sure.
You know, I've always wondered about that, how, I mean, dogs can look so different, and cats can look one breed of cat to another, one breed of dogs to another. What is it about them that makes us look at that and say, yes, that's a cat, or yes, that's a dog? And not, you know, because
I know it's like it's also their way of moving. And well, yeah,
I mean, honestly, a Chihuahua has more in common with a rat than it does with a Great Dane. And yet we still think it's
a dog.
I know.
I mean, apologies to Chihuahua owners, but that's never been my favorite breed.
So, I mean, no, that's not a slam on Chihuahuas because rats are very smart.
They are very smart.
Yeah.
So are pigs.
Yeah. So, Erica, welcome to Writer's Voices.
Thank you so much for having me, Monica and Caroline.
And this is your Girl in Ice is your third novel. Is that correct?
It is.
Or third published novel.
Third published novel.
Just this is something we like to ask our authors. How many unpublished novels did you write?
Oh, yeah, those. I mean, at least seven.
Wow.
Yeah, at least, you know, I think I'm a slow learner. But I felt like, writing a book is a novel that's going to work is incredibly difficult process. There's so many elements that are required, so many skills required, you know, plot, pacing, dialogue, character development, know your genre. It is like, I would argue it's as complex as performing surgery. I mean, it is the things you have to keep in mind, and then at the same time, you know, you sort of have to let yourself go. You know, you have to go to a certain kind of wonderful place where you can access something almost sort of supernatural, you know, to create what you're trying to create.
So it sounds like you learned to write novels by doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I got my master's, all due respect to, Boston University, great school, master's in creative writing, but it's that's like the very, very beginning of what I went on to discover and learn. And you learn the hard way, like, you know, pretty much everything else. Yeah.
So how did you know what, you know, when you were ready to publish, you know, when instead of going in a drawer, they, or did you try to send them all out, or were there some you just like, no, this isn't working, no, I'm just going to start over?
Oh, wow. Yeah, you're digging in the ancient history here. But in any case, I feel like I had, you know, over the course of 30 years, I've had five agents. I won't take you through everything that happened with them. I mean, yeah, I guess, you know, one died, one had a baby, left the business. One was just too far distant from New York's hubbub to, I think, make anything happen. But it was also a combination of, I mean, sort of the lack of maturity of these manuscripts. And then I did reach a point where I was like, okay, so frustrated that I just self-published. You know, I self-published three times. And I don't regret any of that. I learned so much about marketing and publicity and creating a cover. And just, I also learned just how difficult it is. I mean, something like, you know, 1 million books a year are published. How do you stand out? How do you... How do you find readers? I mean, it is, I think if, you know, publishing companies knew that answer, then every book would be a bestseller. but it remains a mystery in so many ways. I mean, why the Crawdad book and not another book? You know, no trashing the Crawdad book. But, yeah, you know, yeah, where the Crawdads sing is what I'm saying.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, why does one book capture the collective consciousness.
Oh my God. And if they could bottle that and sell it, you know, but they don't know.
No. And a lot of it has to do with the timing because, you know, I think back at the books that were like, so like everybody was talking about at different points in my life and nobody's talking about now. Starting out with the first book, I remember being like, this is the book everybody's reading was Love Story.
Oh my God! Yeah. Cool. I read that
in junior high, you know, and but does anybody? Do you hear anything about that now?
The book has its time.
Yeah. And if that book were published today, would it have been this mega bestseller? No.
I don't think so. Then again, you know, if it was more like sexy 50 Shades of Grey-ish, you know, maybe it was called like Love and Sex Story or something, you know, I mean, who knows? But yeah, I mean, it does, you know, if you've tried to read it, it just sort of feels slightly naive now or
yes,
something.
Yes, and another one from that same era, Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
Oh my God, I just picked that up the other day.
Did you?
What was I thinking? What was my mother thinking? Yeah. But, you know, it's like, Jonathan Livingston Seagull. I mean, I think the same is true in movies and TV shows. Things we used to think were so like.
Oh, I know. Do you remember Billy Jack?
No, I don't. What's Billy Jack?
Billy Jack was this. There were several movies of Billy Jack, and he was this. This was also during the 70s, and he was like this kind of rebel who went up against the powers to be and. And we just thought he was such a hero. And I watched it once. Well, this is still a long time ago, but maybe 20 years later. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, I'd be rooting for the other side now.
Well, I mean, just stuff like, you know, I'm really aging myself here, but like Laughing and, you know, oh, God, Gunsmoke. I mean. Really.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Caroline, what were the really popular book when you were young? Do you remember
or
any?
Even movie or
movie? Oh,
that was a long time ago. Well,
that's okay.
movies back then were musicals mostly.
That's right.
And you know, yeah, and you know, every week we would go to the movies, and there was a different music. I mean, they were great. They were just great, and you know, yeah, these dancers and singers and oh gosh, you know, that was the best of times for movies.
It was very beautiful. I mean, those kinds of skills aren't as, I mean, sure. I mean, it was sort of, you know, frankly, I mean, you have to say a little bit sexist, a little bit Mad Men era, you know, all that. But I mean, the singing, the dancing.
Oh, yeah.
And the clothes. Yeah. Right.
And the clothes.
Oh,
yeah.
The people.
Yeah.
When people used to care about like, just like, the, you know, just fitted and beautiful and crazy gorgeous stuff. Yeah.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Erica Forensic, author of Girl in Ice. So maybe I just want to come back to something you said earlier. So
sure.
You self-published three books before like the three that you are now known for. Is
right. And I never really answered your question. You asked me, you know, what made me sort of be able to finally publish a book in the traditional world. I think I had really reached my lowest point. And I was thinking, you know, I had to consider, because the book before I'd written had these sort of, ironically, heavy supernatural elements. And I was told, and this was actually a different time, like 10 years ago, you know, books like that aren't selling. So I was like, okay, it's true. So see how times change, right? So back then I was like, all right, I have this idea. It's about four women who go whitewater rafting in northern Maine, lose the raft, and have to survive. And that's called The River at Night. That was my debut. And I had such a great feeling about this book. And I did what the first of three trips to research a book. And for that book, I spent 2.5 weeks in the Allagash Territory of northern Maine in winter. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. Interviewing people who had disappeared themselves. Okay. Who were off the gritters. Because I wanted to know what they were like. And I was terrified before I went. I didn't know any people who lived off the grid. And then I called all the chambers of commerce from here to Fort Kent in Maine saying, do you know anyone? And they're like, yeah, we don't, you know, we do, but they don't want to talk to you. That's why they live off the grid. But if you left alone. So I said, well, anyway, I kept pushing. And finally I got, you know, five men and two families to talk to. And I was petrified, but I vetted them because I don't, you know, want to die. I ended up, it was an amazing experience. I mean, they all offered me a meal. They all offered me a place to stay. And their place to stay was a bus or a boat on land or this, you know, crazy looking log cabin. And their stories were incredible. So I guess to finally answer your question for this book, The River at Night, which was my debut and an Oprah pick and all this wonderful stuff, I just had a great feeling about it. And I felt like after, 30 years of writing, I'd finally maybe written something that had a market, you know, would find its place in the marketplace. And then for my subsequent two books that were all published with Simon & Schuster, Scout, Gallery Scout, I've gone out to the setting for Into the Jungle. I went to Peru. I spent a month in Peru, in the Peruvian jungle with a guide.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. So
that was terrifying.
Were you like, are you like a long-term outdoors person, or was this all new to you?
I think it all started with The River at Night. When I was writing that, like I said, I was at this really low point in my life. I had lost my job. I couldn't find another job for like literally a year. And I have woods behind my house. And I said, okay, Erica, you can do one thing. You can take a walk for an hour every day. So I started doing that. And that became like the anchor for my day. And it changed me, I mean, in ways I can't even describe. I mean, of course, people know now that being in nature is a great mood enhancer. It certainly was for me. And then from there, I just became fascinated with the natural world and so on and so forth. And that's where I got the idea for The River at Night. So I feel like that's the point where I became enraptured with the natural world. And also, I really enjoy setting my stories in sort of foreboding settings. You know, I really like jungle. I know. So Into the Jungle. So that's the story of a young American woman who goes to Bolivia. She falls in love with a Bolivian man who is one in the a long line of jaguar hunters. His nephew is killed by a jaguar. So he's enlisted to go back deep, deep into the jungle to try to get this jaguar. And so the young woman, she's American. She's 19. She's like, this is the first time I've really been in love. And we do crazy things when we're in love, right? So she follows him in, and she has to survive poachers, the setting, all kinds of things. So that was my second novel, Into the Jungle. And then I wrote Girl in Ice, which is, you know, set in Greenland, where I spent 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks in 2019.
Wow. So what like spark, well, first of all, tell us what the kind of the storyline behind Girl in Ice is, and then what sparked that story for you?
Well, the storyline is, yes, I will tell you first what it's about, and then it's about an American linguist named Val, who is tasked to go to a very remote climate research center off the coast of Greenland, where a girl has been found in the ice, and she's thawed out alive, speaking a language no one understands. And the second part, so that's the mystery part. The thriller part is that Val has a little bit of an anxiety disorder, and she's a very, you know, conservative linguist. She's a little bit scared of the natural world. And her brother, Andy, was at this climate research center with Wyatt, who runs the center. And a year previous, her brother, Andy, wandered outside 50 degrees below zero and froze to death. Now, everyone seems to believe that Andy was suicidal, but she doesn't quite buy that. So that when she goes to Greenland to try to understand what this girl is saying, she goes wondering if Wyatt did something, or there's another woman there, Jean. She's sort of a grunt. She does all the mechanical work, a much older woman. She just doesn't know what she's walking into. As well as this incredibly threatening environment of the land of, you know, when I went there, I just couldn't believe the scale. You know, just you read about it, you see the pictures, but, you know, you get off the plane and it's like there is, well, nothing. I mean, anyway, so then you asked, the story came about, and I think a lot of authors would relate to this. Comes from something I saw. It also came from a memory I can't get out of my head. One day I was walking back in my woods, winter 2018, by a pond, and there were these turtles. It was just kind of lined up along the edge, and they were frozen, and they were sort of frozen mid-stroke, you know, and I was like, they don't look dead, but they don't look alive either. So I went back and, you know, Google, and like, can something freeze and thaw out alive? And I found a lot of creatures could. This was a painted turtle, a juvenile painted turtle. Some kind of wood frogs can do it, freeze and thaw out. There's a tiny, tiny creature called a tardigrade. It's 0.59 millimeters. This little creature can survive 359 degrees below zero for years. They've shot this thing out in space.
Oh, my gosh.
It's adorable. Google it. It's like, it's cute. It's called a water bear.
Caroline, tell what you just heard from my daughter.
Yeah. I just heard in Florida, iguanas.
Iguanas. Exactly, Caroline.
Yeah.
Has anyone fallen out of the tree on
yeah,
your head?
Yeah, yes. Not, no, yeah. But my yeah. daughter was there. She spends part of her time in Florida, and she was telling us this about them falling out of the trees, and it's like,
that's so crazy.
But sometimes they crack, like they break.
Oh, you're kidding. Now, that's a detail I wasn't aware of.
I think she said that. Maybe I'm imagining that, but I think she said that.
You have a vivid imagination, Monica.
Well, yeah, but the rest of the story was this man decided he was going to gather them up and eat them. And so he put them in his car. Well, while he was driving around gathering them up, they started to thaw.
Oh, my God. Exactly. And they were fine, probably, right?
I don't know why you'd want to eat an iguana anyway, but.
Yeah, I know. Desperate times, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
No, I've seen pictures of crocodiles with their noses out of the water, just frozen in a pond, just hanging out till it's thawed, you know.
Wow.
So that was the initial image. Amazing. And then I thought, well, why not, you know, a girl in ice? And I thought, where would this happen? And I just have been fascinated by Greenland forever. And I thought, what would be her story? You know, why is she there? What happened to her? And why is she able to thaw out alive? So that forced me to concoct that story. And so in another image that's sort of followed me my whole life, and I'm still unclear as to why, is, have you seen Frankenstein? The movie, there's a black and white movie. I think it's the 1931 version.
I've never seen it. How about you, Mom? Did you see it?
No.
No?
Well, it's a black and white movie, and it's, you know, it has issues because it's an old movie. But there's this one scene, and it's toward the end, and it's after Frankenstein's monster has been just chased and brutalized and hunted, you know, and he's like, sick of mankind. He's done with mankind. And he's walking, you know, this huge, black, rugged, blocky silhouette, you know. And he's walking into this snowstorm. And he said, screw it, basically. I'm going to go north. I'm going to go where no man goes, you know. Mm-hmm. And this scene of him, and he's walking into this blizzard, and you just see less and less and less of him until it's just white. You know, and I just, that image has just haunted me my whole life. This
interesting.
And believe me, you know, my story, it's not about Frankenstein. Okay. But it is life from death.
Yeah.
It is life from death. Or kind of death, or suspended animation anyway. So those two things, it really propelled me to write the story. And I wrote it. I always write a first draft before I go on these trips because, I mean, the setting, nothing's more important than the story. You know, you've got to have the story, in my opinion, you've got to have the story. The setting is, in many of my books, a character in the story. But, you know, so anyway, so I had that, and then and the second reason I really need to know the story is because, you know, when I do, anytime I do research, I need to know what I'm looking for. Mm. Because it's a big world out there, and it's a fascinating world. And so if I were to just go to Greenland or go to Peru, the jungle, and say, wow, look at that snake, like, why is that important? I need to know who to interview, what to ask them, that kind of thing. So that's pretty much the beginning, the genesis of the story.
Wow.
Well, I can see why this is such an interesting book, because you really, well, like you say, boots on the ground. You really get into it. I mean, you live it.
Good. Oh, you did? Good.
Yeah.
Did you wear a sweater, Caroline?
Oh, I was going to tell you too, another thing that movies was kind of interesting. Yeah, there were those, you know, fun movies, but there are also a lot of Dracula and Frankenstein and Wolfman movies.
Totally. I was totally, you know, you could I was into those. Yeah. Yeah. And now it's kind of, you know, the undead running around and all that. But, you know, that's a whole other bag of wax, I guess, but
so Girl in Ice has a lot about climate change, really. There's that theme running through it. Do your other books also deal with that at all, or is this the first time?
Well, that's a great question. I was thinking about that. You know, books reflect what an author is thinking. I know that sounds simplistic, but I have gone from not thinking about climate change at all 10 years ago to having it be almost every other thought I have.
Mm-hmm.
And so of course, that's beginning to be reflected in my books. I don't believe there was much of a mention of it in The River at Night. In Into the Jungle, yeah, it was part of the plot. And in Girl and Ice, it's a huge part of the plot. Let me put it this way. I don't inject climate change in there because, oh, it's topical. No one cares about that. You're reading a novel because you want to be entertained. You want to be taken on a ride, your crazy ride, out of your life, out of your head. So, yeah, I'm not saying that, you know, I put it in there for that reason. It's just part of our lives right now. Yeah. And it helps us to process. It's kind of like watching a scary movie. It's like, well, you know, I like to imagine the worst that can happen. And then you turn the TV off and it hasn't happened or it hasn't happened yet. You know, so I think that climate change in novels offers a huge, I mean, sad as it is, it offers a huge opportunity to explore this world mm-hmm. that we live in. And also, and so, you know, and in my next novel, it's going to be a pivotal part of mm-hmm. even more than in Girl and Ice.
And novels are actually a great way to get people thinking about something that maybe they weren't thinking about before. Instead of hitting them over the head with it, it's like...
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and all normalizes thinking of it. It's like, oh, I'm scared mm-hmm. of that too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, I'm terrified of that too. That I wasn't able to put it into words. I mean, you know, Andy, who was the brother in this book who went out and froze to death, was extremely depressed about climate change. And he couldn't get over it. So, you know, I'm not going to say what happened to him, but that was a big suspicion that he did it because he was seeing too many horrible things, and he did what he did or didn't do what he did. See, I'm not going to tell you.
Yeah. So you shouldn't tell us.
He and Valerie were twins, weren't they? Wasn't he a twin brother?
Yes, fraternal twins.
Yeah, which makes it another element because twins are, let's face it, you know, they run on the same path so a lot of times. So that's, you know, that was an interesting part of it, I thought. I really did.
Thank you.
Erica, I meant to look this up. I didn't, but I will ask you. Was it ice winds? Is that what they were called? These winds that were like froze people? Is that a real thing?
Yeah. Okay, I made that up.
Okay,
so
okay.
But doesn't that feel real?
Yes.
It feels very real.
Oh,
yes.
It does.
So in the course of the book, one of the things that starts happening is that people here and there, just seven people here, five people here, someplace in the world are killed by something I call an ice wind, which is a very strong, very cold wind that kills them instantly. And I guess that came from, well, extreme temperature gradients and how they can create these winds. And actually, I'm not making that part up. There are winds called pitaraks, which shoot down. We don't live on glaciers, but that's why we don't feel them. But they shoot down from the glaciers, and they can go sometimes 200 miles an hour. They're 100 degrees below zero, 50 degrees below zero. And actually, it happened in a small town in Tisilak in Greenland. They had these terrible winds like 10 years ago, something like that. But so I guess, not unlike the girl in ice who thaws out alive, I take what is could be true, and I make it true in the book.
Right.
I mean, think about it. I can't freeze you, Monica. I can't freeze you, Carolyn, and you thaw out alive. However, I can freeze a human embryo.
Yeah.
I could freeze mm-hmm. a human embryo because it's only 120 cells or something like that, and they figured out a way. Don't ask me, I'm not a scientist, but they figured out a way to thaw that thing out alive. It's like, how far can it be from that to us?
Well, there are people who believe that.
Absolutely.
That I mean, there are people who are freezing their bodies, right?
That's
do they do it after they die or before they die or just?
I think it's, you know, I don't know. Yeah, in hopes that when they thaw out. Now, when you freeze a cell, you damage it, because think about ice. Think about a cell, it's all happy and round and soft. But when you freeze it, you make ice, and you make a sharp edge, and that damages the cell. But in these creatures we've talked about, they produce a natural cryoprotein, which protects their cells. Now, if we could isolate that cryoprotein and somehow, I mean, you know, I don't know. I'm just talking like a novelist, not like a scientist, but, you know.
Well, one of the reasons that the ice winds seemed so believable to me is because until a year and a half ago, and when I'm right in this office sitting outside and saw for the first time, I had never heard of a derecho before.
Right.
A derecho. Is that how you say it? Yes.
I'm not sure how you say it, actually. But
I'm not sure how you say it.
But anyway, it blew right through my yard. And it was like sitting here looking out the window. And I'm like, what in the world is going on out there? And I went out and, oh, my gosh, this wind. Now, we were on the edge of it, so we didn't get any damage. But I had never even heard of such a thing. And for those of you who still don't know what it is, it's basically a horizontal tornado kind of.
Tornado,
almost.
Yeah. And they're called, I just found it, they're called catabatic winds. And they're like, they're all over the world. The Santa Ana winds are considered catabatic winds.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. The derecho, the Pitirox in Greenland. But, you know, my theory for the book was, which takes place, you know, a couple of years from now. Think about today. I live outside of Boston. It's, it's going to be 57 degrees on Saturday. The next day, it's going to be 27 degrees.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that happens all the time here.
Right.
That happens all the time in Iowa. Yeah, it's not uncommon to have a 40-degree temperature swing in a day. It happens all the time.
Yes, but
it always
40,
did.
But then you go outside.
Oh, it always did.
It always did here.
So much for that theory.
Yeah, it always did here. But we have Iowa has some of the most extreme temperatures, because it can be minus 20 in the winter and it can be 110 in the summer. And so there aren't too many other places that have that wide a range. Now, we'll only have one or two days of each of those. Or maybe none some years, but it can happen and does happen.
Do you find it's happening
more frequently?
You
know, there's this old saying: in Iowa, if you don't like the weather, wait around; it'll change. You know,
we have the same thing in New England. Yeah,
yeah. So I don't know that if it's happening more or not. I think, in general, the winters are. Yeah, a little more extreme. I think we used to have longer periods where it would stay below freezing, and now it goes up, it goes down, it goes up, it goes down. Yeah, it was zero last week, and it was 50 yesterday, you know.
But the wind,
the
wind does make a big difference.
The animals are feeling that, too. The trees are hearing, the trees are feeling that, too. Do we bloom? Do we not bloom?
What's
You know, three days of 50 and above, it starts to... We've had buds, you know, just die in the next storm. But,
yeah.
We got to solve this problem.
Yeah. The other reason that this concept of ice winds seemed real to me was I was remembering that story I'd read about the couple with their baby and their dog hiking out west somewhere who just died, and they didn't know why. And I did. And,
oh, my God, that's right.
Yeah.
It took the longest time to...
To figure it out. And I don't even remember what the answer was.
Oh, it's hard. They didn't go. I could be wrong, but forgive me, listeners, if I got this wrong. But I think it was a combination of heat stroke and dehydration.
Yeah.
All of that? I mean, and the dog?
I know. And they were experienced hikers, and you just wouldn't think that that would have happened.
Yes.
So,
yep.
So the things that happen in Girl and Ice are not unbelievable at all.
Exactly. And so I really did that on purpose, because I'm not interested in writing science fiction. You know, this is not science fiction. There is that one speculative element, which, you know, you have to buy it. You have to buy that this girl did thaw out alive. And if you're ready to play on that game, come on along and I'll take you on a wild ride. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm not going to throw, you know, aliens in your face.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. And our guest today is Erica Forensic, author of Girl in Ice. And Erica, would you like to read from the book for us today?
Sure. You know, the basic characters. Val is the linguist. She's a professor of Nordic and dead languages. She travels to this climate research center off the coast of Greenland, where Wyatt, who runs the place, is there. And he was the one who worked with the brother, Andy, who died by walking outside and freezing to death. The girl, you eventually learn her name is Sigrid. These are just things you need to know before I start to read. And there is one other character, well, there are a couple other characters, but there's one other character named Jean. Jean is the mechanic who lives at this remote climate research center. She's someone who, she's an odd duck. She's lost her family in an accident. She's sort of, there's a lot of dealing with grief in this story. Everyone deals with it in their own way. And the way she's dealt with it is just get away from everyone. Be a cook and a mechanic in an extremely remote location. But she did witness the thawing of this girl. So that's the little part I'm going to read here at this time. Okay. Her skin was so cold, but not hard anymore. It was softening by the minute. But we had to give her time because, you know, things thaw from the outside in, so we were patient. But soon we checked for breathing or a pulse, and of course there was nothing, so I was getting nervous. I couldn't believe we were disrespecting a body like this, a body that had been at peace in the ice. What were we going to do now? If she was dead, and it sure looked like it, how would we bury her in the frozen ground? Then her left hand twitched under the blanket. We both yelped and jumped back. After a while, I thought we both imagined it. But then her jaw dropped and her mouth opened and closed. So we checked for a heartbeat, nothing. So soon, boom, right away, Wyatt was on her with the defibrillator. Just about bounced her off the table, she's so small. But he did it again and nothing. She wasn't breathing. Her eyes still glazed over, both hands still, like what we'd seen was just some side effect of a body thawing. And I begged him to stop, but he wouldn't. I begged him, in Francis's honor, Francis was my daughter, to stop. I said, Wyatt, maybe this is some rigor mortis thing setting in. Just leave her be. Must have been the 10th try. Something changed. You could feel it in the room, this crackling energy filling it up. Wyatt was looking down at her, smiling. From where I sat, I saw her hand shoot up and sort of smack his arm, and I screamed and jumped and ran over. The girl was coughing and gagging, threw up all over the floor, but she was breathing. Wyatt, I mean, he was spotted with puke, but he had this look of rapture, like he was in his own sort of church. Standing next to him like that, watching her try to breathe, this little, filthy, naked child, hair in knots, I felt like, in a weird way, we were her parents, or her second set of parents, you know what I'm saying? I mean, he started her little heart, but we worked together to bring her out of the ice, to bring her alive. Think about that. And the next part I'm going to read is... This little short scene, very short, is Val. She's with Sigrid. She cannot understand what this girl is saying. She's speaking a language that Val, who knows these languages for, you know, has been studying for 25 years, has no idea what she's saying. And the girl is around 7, and she's been wearing this Christmas sweater for a month that she just refuses to take off. This stretched out old Christmas sweater from Wyatt. So this is Val saying, her face screwed up in confusion. I motioned for her to come out. Fear in her eyes, wild black hair sticking up every which way, she took a few steps into the hall, glancing both ways. Santa's reindeer, led by Rudolph, his nose a puffy red ball sewn onto the loose knit, flew diagonally up the sweater. Her tiny toes, blackened with grime, poked from under the ragged hem. "Standala," she whispered hoarsely. She looked at me with such pleading in her dark eyes, I simply wasn't ready for it. The frank reality of her, this girl from ice. Just a child, but from what world and how could I possibly enter it? "Who are you, dear child?" I drew in a sharp breath, uttering a cry. What should I do? I had no children, no nieces or nephews. Sure, if you were 18 and wanted to major in Latin or Greek, I could handle it. But this? And the last scene I'm going to read. The last scene is with Wyatt, and he is talking about himself. He, again, remember, he is a climate researcher. He works with ice cores. So when I say cores, I mean ice cores. And he was Andy's professor. That was their relationship. So he's talking to Val. Wyatt got comfortable at his desk. Sigrid returned to her scribbling. He said, "I've never been more passionate about what I'm doing." He leaned forward, face half in shadow. "I'm not just curious about stuff. I have to know. Those odd striations a mile down in the ice core. What's the explanation? How does the world work? It's almost like sexual frustration, which is pretty much my constant state anyway." He laughed ruefully. "It's like I'm a little pissed off all the time, that I don't have all the answers to my questions right away. But if I had them, what would be left for me to care about?" He lowered his voice. "And Val, listen, I love Dandy, you know that. But I care about all my students. So many of them are going to go on to change the world. They're doing it now. I'm very proud." He rubbed his forehead, exhaustion plain in the deep creases of his face. "So what's left? I've got these cores, this 15-year body of work, which I'm damn proud of. But now it's the girl. The girl is everything. The reality of her, the science of her, the why of her." So that's why it's a little obsessiveness coming out.
Oh, wow.
So that's all I'm going to read.
Well, thank you. That was Erica Forensic reading from Girl in Ice.
For now, the first time, you know. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, you're the first one, girlfriend.
All right. Well, we are honored.
My cat was in the way. Oh, God. He gets jealous when I speak.
Now, Girl in Ice is coming out March 1st,
yep.
Correct? Yep. And, or in case you're listening to this later, came out March 1st, 2022.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And you've mentioned you've been doing a lot of interviews, getting a lot
it
of
will be.
Yeah. And, yeah. You know, we're still in the times of COVID.
Yes.
So, is there any book tour?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Go to my website. You know, knock on wood, I'm really hoping that my launch can be in person. It's scheduled to be in person. And then I'm going on a book tour. I'm going to North Carolina, and then I'm going on to the Tucson Book Festival. But I'm also doing lots of virtual events, lots of talks like this. Just go to my website. That's really the best place to go. My name, ericaforensic.com.
Awesome.
And that's constantly updated. Not quite enough updated, but like my author page on Facebook, that's a really efficient way. You know all the channels, folks.
Yeah.
You're all good.
So the launch party for Girl in Ice is March 1st at Brookline Booksmith in Brookline,
yep.
Massachusetts. Awesome.
And we will have fun. I'm going to do a whole presentation about Greenland called Journey to Greenland, so you really get a feel for the place. Maybe a place that you won't have a chance to go in your lifetime. Who knows?
Yeah.
But but oh, so there, man.
Now, the title of this book, The Girl in Ice, I mean, not the, just Girl in Ice, is it just me or does it have a double meaning?
Girl in Ice. Well, it's interesting when you, I want to know what you're saying. I mean, it's like, Girl in Ice.
Well, know, obviously
like,
there's a girl
so
who
literal.
Was,
what did I do with that?
It was but... so frozen in, you know, the girl was frozen in ice, but Val
yes. okay.
was also frozen in place.
Yep. So true, and I think that bizarrely didn't hit me until I mean I'm serious about that until I saw the cover and I was like, oh, that could be the girl, that could be Val,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it does look like a grown up, but it's pretty blurry. So
yeah, because she was. You said she had a little bit of anxiety disorder. I think she had a pretty severe
a little
solid
bit. Anxiety disorder.
Yeah.
Here she is, this linguist, and she's never been to all these places where she could have studied language. You know, the caves of China, where all these inscriptions in the rock were found. She got offered a job in Peru to study languages down there, and she just. But it was something about learning about this girl. It just like. Made her want to apply what she knows to the living world, you know, to actually do something that
and, yeah,
makes a difference.
Yeah. Now, I was fascinated with this idea that a single person could know so many languages and have such a deep understanding of so many languages. I'm guessing with the amount of research you do that you've actually talked to some linguists and, you know.
I talked to a couple of different linguists. I mean, I think that for the purposes of the story, I needed her to be pretty conversant in these languages. But I think she, what I meant is with that is she knew enough about them to be able to recognize patterns.
Yeah.
And she wasn't seeing these patterns that she knew in these languages, you know, like all the, like Old Norse or Finnish or Norwegian or Danish or even Greenlandic, more significantly.
Yeah.
So the mystery is where or when.
Because they don't know how long she had been frozen there. There was some theory that it was fairly recent. That was the initial theory.
Yeah. And then, you know, the plot goes on. We won't really. But it was, you know, it's already so sort of fantastical that she thought out, you know, the next step is you've got to read the book.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting, too, how intelligent Sigrid is because she knows what can keep her alive. And
precisely.
That's very interesting.
She knows, but she's so screwed up by what happened to her. She doesn't trust anyone.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I talked to these linguists and I said, well, so how can Val possibly understand this girl if there's no basis in any known language? And they said, well, it'll be kind of like dealing with a baby. You know, you'd have to just start with objects, simple objects and simple verbs and you know, going from there, you know, a bag of marbles to indicate many as opposed to one, for example, one marble, stuff like that. But the missing piece in the beginning of the story anyway is that Sigrid has no interest in talking. She doesn't care. She doesn't see that as a route to her own salvation. She's just she's traumatized. She's like, where am I?
Yeah.
Where is my family? Can you imagine waking up and you're in a complete, you don't even know who the people are that are in your house?
And you don't know what happened to anyone. You don't know what happened to you.
And you're a child.
And
you're angry. And you don't have the things you want. And the food is weird. And where are my clothes? And... So she's just, you know, furious and traumatized and does not want to speak until she finally understands that learning how to communicate is pivotal for her to survive.
Now, there's a couple other characters in the book that you haven't mentioned who are there at the research station as well, doing other types of research. And is this based on things that are really being done at these climate research stations?
As far as I know, I mean, there are people studying things all over the world.
Yeah.
My next book has to do with mushrooms, and I'm really not going to talk much more about it than that. But you wouldn't believe the level of detail of the research that's going on around the world in order to find out what might be being researched. I joined a couple of Arctic research website newsletters. You know, so-and-so gets a grant for studying, you know, infant walrus noises today as opposed to 20 years ago. I mean, this is really like esoteric stuff.
So what were these two scientists studying?
Well, Raj was studying, he was into plant biology, Arctic, you know, kelp, basically.
And which included meaning having to dive below the ice.
Dive below the ice.
Which to me is terrifying. It's a terrifying
idea.
That's
why I'm in there, honey. It's terrifying. That's actually one of my biggest fears in life. And when I write these books, like, what would I never do? Sure, I'll go to Greenland, but I would never. Anyway, diving in regular water, I'm just.
Yeah, right.
Hey.
You won't find me there. And I just like. To dive under the ice? Oh, please.
No.
Oh,
no. No way.
No way. So, of course, they had to dive under the ice. Yep. And then Nora was studying basically, you know, whale song and seal, the noises animals made and how, and their, what had happened to them with climate change. Were they retreating from a certain place, going to another place? So, yeah, and they're a couple very much in love and very confused by the whole situation too, but very much trying to concentrate on their own research because they have very limited time, because this book is set at the end of, let's put it this way, it's completely dark where they were by October 25th. Hmm. And the sun right? And the sun does not rise until February, to like now. Okay?
Oh gosh.
It's crazy. So these people were also under the time pressure of, they had got a grant, you know, I'm researching, feel like they had this grant, we're going to get this information, we have very limited time, and they were trying to live their life, whereas while all this other drama is going on with Val and Wyatt and Sigrid and Jean. So, but it's a very small crew there, so I won't go into what happens, but there's some diving under the ice.
Okay, so I got to ask, you know, they're in an area, they're in this place where one wrong step and you could be dead, really. Why was Val so resistant to signing out when she left the safe place and went outside? It's like she kept not signing out, and so if something happened to her, nobody would know where she was.
You know, I think that's a great question. I think she was one of these people that is a little bit on the spectrum, not that there's anything wrong with that, but had a lack of ability to concentrate on everything all at once. I mean, that's how I meant it, but then, you know, then I think, yeah, she probably should have signed out. But it's also a dramatic element too, at different points. But
well, that is true.
That is true. You know, the thing, she didn't sign out, but when she heard that noise, she went to see what it was.
I know.
You know, she left the building. Yeah.
Yeah. Not too smart.
Not too smart. You know, one of those smart. Stupid people. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So how much of Val is you?
Well, I'm all of them because, you know, it's all about me, Monica. You know, I'm Wyatt. I'm like the frustrated person who wants to know everything about the world and just give it to me. And I'm Val because I'm terrified when I wake up in the morning. Aren't we all these days? and I have to get over. I'm an extrovert and an introvert. I'm sacred because I want to communicate, and then I don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, it's very hard. There's little bits of me in all of them, and then, I do have this feeling of awe about the world, and I'm just in love with just the wonder that remains and the mysteries that remain. We have a simultaneous need for wonder, and then this and mystery, and then this impulse to destroy it. And that fascinates me. But I believe there's plenty of mystery left in the world, and human beings need that. Human beings need to wonder.
And you're going to help give them things to wonder about.
Yep. Indeed. Yes, indeed.
Well, Erica, we have really enjoyed our conversation today, and we're completely out of time.
Oh, boy.
And, Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
Yes, I do. It was really kind of hard to find an appropriate one, but I found a thing that Desmond Tutu said, the differences in people are not intended to separate and alienate. We are different precisely in order to realize our need of one another.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Okay.
Bye-bye.